So we will meet for Samsara and Nirvana over the next 4 Mondays from 7 to 8:30. Stephanie Smith will be our instructor for this class. And so again, Monday evenings all through June from 7 to 8:30. And for more information about Discovering Buddhism, as well as the Discovering Buddhism materials, please go to the Kadampa Center website, which is kadampa-center.org. And there you will find across kind of the top part of that webpage, a tab called Spiritual Programs. And if you click on that, you can access all of the Discovering Buddhism program materials. And it starts off up top with a lot of the readings for each of the modules. But if you scroll down a little further, there'll be a section. I haven't set it up yet, but it will be set up tonight. There'll be a section called Samsara and Nirvana, and that's where homework will be posted, as well as the about this module, the specific information about this module. So if you are working towards a certificate for the module, you can keep track of all of your readings and any practices and meditations and homework that's assigned. You can keep track of that on that about this program a handout that'll be posted on the website, hopefully tonight. Let's see here. What else did I want to say? Oh, the Kadampa Center webpage is a great resource. Tons of information there. One of my favorite places to go is actually to the calendar. So if you go to the website, kadampa-center.org, and look in the upper right-hand corner, there's a calendar. You can click on that calendar and see all the amazing things that are coming up. And speaking of amazing things, we just had a whole week of teachings with Venerable Rabina. So I think some of you were able to join us for that. And so that's a good place to see what's coming up in the next, you know, weeks or even months. And then let's see. So we are holding class through Zoom, but what you see on the Zoom, if you're joining us through Zoom, what you see on your Zoom screen is what will be live streamed via YouTube as well. So it's a little bit different than what we've been doing in the past. I'm at home, and our instructor Steep is also at home. Everyone is at home this time. And so this stream is actually coming right off of our computers. So if you do have questions, and sorry for this very long introduction, but if you do have questions, please use the chat box and type those questions into chat. Chat should be located in the bottom part of your screen. If you just put your cursor on your screen, that should pop up. And you can just ask your question right in that chat. I'll be monitoring chat on both YouTube and Zoom tonight, and we will try to get your questions answered if at all possible this evening. Now, if you've joined us for Discovering Buddhism in the past, you may remember that for the first class, we do show an introduction video that is put together by FPMT, and that is the foundation for the preservation of the Mahayana tradition, which is the big umbrella that Kadampa Center falls under, and is our leader of the FPMT is Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And so there's, again, lots of information and resources on that website as well. FPMT.org, and that's where you can find information about that 14th Discovering Buddhism module as well. So we're going to attempt to go ahead and start sharing that video, that introduction video from YouTube. So I'm going to switch over now and start sharing that screen. So just bear with me for a moment. If there is a problem with that, please let me know, and I will try to rectify that. Where is this?
Mind, it's totally free of all limitations and no longer controlled by destructive emotions. Join us in looking more deeply at samsara and how we're caught in it, and nirvana and how we are liberated by it.
Samsara and Nirvana. On the one hand, samsara, or cyclic existence, is suffering and its causes. On the other end of the spectrum, there's Nirvana, complete freedom, complete liberation from that suffering and its causes. Our current situation is that we're in cyclic existence, in samsara. And where we want to go is nirvana, complete freedom. But there's no way that we can get there without an intention to do so, without a strong motivation. So before listening to the teachings, right now, generate a strong motivation in your own mind to learn as much as possible about both samsara, our current situation, and nirvana, where we want to go, in order to be able to achieve that freedom for the benefit of all sentient beings as quickly as possible.
To explain a little bit more about to get a real idea of what samsara means, you know,
the depth of samsara, so that one can begin to feel compassion for oneself and a feeling of what is the meaning of renunciation, you know, that thought renouncing samsara. So
we first have to know exactly what samsara means to generate this wish to overcome samsara. So samsara, what it really means. And there is one explanation that includes, we call, three levels, you know, of suffering. Three kinds of suffering. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to explain this first, yeah? The first one is called suffering of pain. And that includes all the ordinary pains, physical pains, sickness, hurt, and our mental problems of suffering of separation, you know, dissatisfaction, depression, anxiety, fear, worry. There's usually only that level of suffering that we are aware of, you know, in our daily life, that we are trying to overcome. But samsaric suffering has much more to it than that, you know. The second level of samsara we call the suffering of change. And the suffering of change is much more subtle and difficult to comprehend, you know. It's all about how the pleasures that we seek in samsara, the temporary pleasures, are in fact all in the nature of suffering, because they change into dissatisfaction and eventually pain. You know? So we say, although we called it pleasure, in fact it's in the nature of suffering. Yeah, we give it the name pleasure, but somehow when we analyze it, we can see eventually always turns into suffering or misery, you know. The third kind of suffering that explains samsaric existence, you know, is the we call all pervading suffering, or pervasive suffering. Pervasive because it covers all of our existence, our body and our mind, you know. Is in the nature of this all-pervasive suffering. So everything within our ordinary body and mind is a product, you know, of suffering, and creates more suffering. So it's in the nature of suffering. When we understand these levels of suffering, we can look at samsara and see the faults of samsaric existence, you know. That there is nothing within samsaric existence that gives us satisfaction or happiness or is uncontaminated. But if we meditate on it, we can start to develop disgust with samsaric suffering. Especially when we realize that we have the potential to be free.
For Buddhists, samsara is but a way of looking at the world that is associated with attachment and self-cherishing and the desire that things be as we wish them to be. And since this whole notion of the world being as we wish it to be, since our wanting the world to remain a certain way cannot be met, is always subject to failure, because the true nature of the world is impermanence and changingness all the time. Those desires to keep it permanent will inevitably lead to suffering. The Buddha taught Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There is a cause of suffering. There's a cessation of suffering. There's a path leading to the cessation of suffering. The Buddha said, from his own experience, after he had meditated 6 years and performed these incredibly rigorous meditations, he said, I've discovered this truth. There's suffering. And I've also discovered that it's possible to end it. And so after he had taught for 45 years in India, looking back on what he accomplished, he said, I've taught only two things, suffering and its end. Now, if you wanted to capture Buddhist doctrine as a whole, what you'd say and what you'd have to look at, and all that you'd have to look at, are those Four Noble Truths. Okay, so if we take them one by one now. There is suffering, dukkha, the Buddha said. He said, what constitutes suffering is almost anything we can imagine. Birth is suffering, death is suffering, aging is suffering, old age is suffering, pain, grief, lamentation is suffering. The second noble truth says there's a cause of suffering. There is desire, craving, and this is the most palpable cause of our suffering. But it's only the most palpable cause. We desire things to be permanent. We desire to get what we want. We desire to get away from what we don't want. And so that desire is one of the things that keeps samsara in motion. The root cause is our own ignorance about the way in which we exist and all other things exist. We try to hold on to something's being permanent that is by its nature impermanent. That leads to frustration. So ignorance is the basic cause of suffering. The optimistic part about Buddhism is that after showing us various methods for eliminating the cause of suffering, it offers, in the third noble truth, the end of suffering. And in Buddhist texts of the early school, that cessation is called nirvana. In teachings of the so-called later school, that end is called bodhi, or complete enlightenment. And this is the state that the Buddha himself attained. And attaining the cessation of suffering doesn't put someone in a different place, doesn't put them in a different body, doesn't put them in a different world. It changes their view. They give up the attachment to a self as a fixed, permanent existent. Changing that idea, giving up that idea, abandoning that idea, they find themselves with a new view of things. And that new view of the world is what nirvana is. It's not something else. It's not something apart from us. We have that potential within us to see it that way. If our ignorance is what causes suffering, then our own insight and our own wisdom is what will cause it to cease. So nirvana, as the third noble truth, is held out as the possible end. It is an end to suffering, and such a thing exists. The fourth noble truth says there is a path leading to the cessation of suffering. And that path provides a means for us to realize directly the end of suffering, so that you yourself can see, you know, try it on, try the method on, see what whether it's beneficial or not. And if it is, then keep practicing. Now, this puts the responsibility for our practicing all of these various paths, but primarily the responsibility for gaining insight, right on our shoulders. It's not anywhere else. We have the ability to not only locate the cause, the root cause of suffering, but to eliminate it. We have that responsibility ourselves. It's not to be found in the outside world. It's not put in the hands of anyone else, any deity or any guru, any teacher. It is totally up to us. The Buddha himself said in a scripture that were it up to me, then samsara would be empty. If I could do it for you, samsara would be empty. But I can only show you the way. You yourself have to practice. You yourself have to try it out. You yourself have to investigate. You yourself have to sit on that cushion and meditate.
So in any case, the point is that when we think about liberation, we should not have the notion that it exists outside somewhere as a kind of a physical plane or physical domain. Rather, liberation has to be understood in terms of one's own quality of mind or state of mind. And we spoke about the presence of natural nirvana, the natural purity in all of us, which serves as the basis. And on that basis, when all the obscurations and the afflictions are eliminated, that is the true nirvana, that's the true liberation. And when you go deeper in your understanding of the nature of liberation or moksha, then we can understand it in terms of the ultimate nature of one's own mind. The ultimate nature of one's own mind at a stage when all the afflictions are eliminated, that is the liberation, that is moksha. So we find that actually in the final analysis, it is our ignorance and fundamental misconception of the ultimate nature of reality that lies at the root of our samsaric existence, that lies at the root of our unenlightened existence. Therefore, if it is the ignorance and misconception of the fundamental nature of reality that creates the unenlightened existence, that means it is by cultivating the correct insight into the true nature of reality which will begin the process of undoing this unenlightened existence, which will begin the process of liberation. Therefore, as the Tibetan masters say, that when in ignorant state we are in the samsara, when insight or when the knowledge is developed, generated, then we are liberated. So this samsara and nirvana is distinguished on the basis of whether we are in the state of ignorance or whether we are in the state of knowledge. And so what we find here is that the ultimate antidote for eliminating the
fundamental ignorance, which is the root of cyclic existence, is the wisdom realizing emptiness, wisdom cognizing emptiness. And the emptiness, the ultimate nature of that mind, when all the obscurations have been eliminated, that emptiness of mind is a that quality of mind is the nirvana. That's the final nirvana. So therefore, we can say that that which causes us to be caught in unenlightened existence relate to our ignorance of the fundamental nature of reality, emptiness. So from the Buddhist point of view, this would be explained in terms of in the following way, that in the physical world there is an ever-present continuum at the subtlemost level of a physical continuum. We spoke about this earlier, which is space particles. And then when it interacts, comes into contact with sentient beings, karma acts as a condition, which then give rise to various permutations of the physical reality, so that eventually a macroscopic world comes into being that can actually have direct effect upon sentient beings' experience of pain and pleasure, happiness and suffering. So it is on these lines that the Buddhists would explain the whole evolution and dissolution of universe. This is very clear if you look at the traditional Buddhist teachings on the 12 rings of dependent origination, which gives the picture of the process of evolution within the cycle of existence. We find that the individual's existence in cycle of samsara, unenlightened existence, is explained in terms of this 12 interlocking chain. And here it is very clear that there is no concept of there being some kind of central unifying figure, which is like the kind of the creator of the everything, and then everything sort of revolves around it. Rather, the whole evolution is explained in terms of interlocking 12 sets of 12 chains. So that the point of interlocking is that when, for example, one cycle of 12 links is in progress, before that entire cycle finishes, another cycle is already set in motion. So that while, for example, when you are already experiencing the consequences within 12 chains, already ignorance and the karmic actions and so on, which is part of another cycle, is already set in motion. So in the teachings on the 12 links, the Buddha teaches us that the two sets of 12 links, a cycle of a chain of 12 links. One is the evolution or within the evolution of an individual within the unenlightened existence, starting from ignorance, karmic volitional acts, consciousness, and so on. Then he also explains to us another cycle where the cycle is reversed, which then gives us the reversal process where the process of enlightenment is explained. So by eliminating, by bringing to an end ignorance, then the volitional acts are prevented. By preventing volitional acts, consciousness is prevented, and so on. So the reversal process of unenlightened existence is also explained.
I think the 12 links is a fantastic teaching in terms of getting some fresh respect for the law of cause and effect. Because if you really think that each moment of ignorance is going to produce or will possibly produce a cause for one's next rebirth in samsara, that's pretty heavy. That's pretty scary. It's going to make... I found for myself that it definitely made me respect a little bit more my choices and my actions. And I think the other thing, of course, especially for Westerners, I think that the picture of the 12 links is kind of powerful, because of course it all begins, you know, the picture with a little old, usually it's a little old lady or a little old man with their stick, you know, because they're blind. And I think that's very challenging, because we like to think we're in control of our lives and that we're somehow this powerful, dynamic being walking through the landscape that we have chosen, making decisions, and, you know, we're in the driving seat, and we're kind of successful at that. And then you see this picture, you think, no, that's some Tibetan thing, you know. And then, of course, when you really think about ignorance and how it's essentially leading us by the nose into this mud of harming ourselves and others and continued dissatisfaction, then yeah, we are pretty much like the little blind old lady, you know, tottering towards a precipice, completely unknowing what her steps are leading towards. So I think that it's a very helpful image that, again, the 12 links can really help you to see that that actually is a direct benefit that you are giving yourself, and a direct benefit that you're giving to others, because every moment that you're consciously choosing not to act out of strong ignorance is a moment towards your enlightenment, and a moment therefore to be able to benefit others. And every moment you think of that, of course, loosens that sense of I'm at the center of the world, you know, you exist for me. And it's like, well, no, I don't think that's true. And, you know, and actually I'm just, you know, existing in dependence upon other beings, in dependence upon causes and effects, in dependence, of course, upon this label, me. So I think that's another way in which we can really use the 12 links to give us not only a sort of a more enjoyable time in our daily life through remembering interdependence, but of course also, you know, trying to use that as a way to get closer to some understanding of selflessness and some, you know, because selflessness and interdependence are the two sides of the same coin, aren't they? So I think for all of those reasons, very helpful practice to try to reflect upon. In fact, I must do it more.
Okay. Was everyone able to see that okay? Hear it okay after I got the sound going? Excellent. Good. I see that Kirsten Ullman has her hand raised. That may have been before the video started. But Kirsten, if you want to unmute and ask your question, if you still have one. Okay. So I did want to mention, I thought of a couple of other things in regards to Zoom. I think most of us are watching via the Zoom platform. So in regards to once Steep begins teaching and starts sharing her screen, just a few quick tips. If you go out of gallery view into just speaker view, and that should be in the top right corner of your computer screen if you're on a computer or a laptop. And put it on speaker view instead of gallery view. And then there should be a place, let me see if I can find it real quick, where you can also view options for how your screen is being shared, or how being viewed rather. And put that on a side-by-side mode. And that way, once if Steep is sharing something on her screen, you'll be able to see that, but you'll also be able to see her in a little box off to the side. So hopefully that will help. And then if you do want to ask a question, you can raise your hand. There's a little raise your hand feature down at the probably at the bottom of your screen. I know sometimes on phones or iPads it's a little different, but at the bottom of your screen, let's see. Oh, that's a thumbs up. Hang on. If you go to your participant, I think it's there. Oh, now I can't find it. Anyway, if you can find where to raise your hand, you can use that feature as well. And I will ask your question to Steve. Okay, so without further ado, I am going to go ahead and turn it over to Steve now. And Steve, we did have a question at the beginning as to why you are called Steve.
I usually save that for the very last class.
Oh! You can wait until then if you want.
So I lived with Geshe Gelug for 9 years. He lived in my house and when he first came to this country. And I helped teach him English and how to drive and things like that. And in the beginning, he would call me Steve, but I thought he was calling me Steve because Tibetan language doesn't have a PH sound. So I would keep telling him, oh, my name's not Steve. And he said, I know. And so this went on for a while. Finally, I said, well, what are you calling me? And he said, I'm calling you Steep, like a steep hill. You're going to go straight up. And I said, okay, Steep also means straight down. So I will use that name as a reminder of which direction I go and is up to me. But that name just kind of stuck. And so now if somebody calls me Steep, I know that they're from the center. But anyway, it's a fun nickname. There's so many Stephanies at my job. It's nice to have another name somewhere else in the world. So welcome, everybody. You know, some of you, this may be your first time. Also, feel free to chat to, you know, privately to Linda so that if she can funnel me questions either at the end. There'll be a little bit of time for questions. But, you know, this is the first time any of us are doing this in a pandemic, or at least the first time we're doing so many things in a pandemic. So I appreciate your patience, and it's just hard. You know, it's just hard. I think the video you just watched, like, summarizes the whole class that we're going to be involved in. And I think if you just look out your window or look in your house, this, you know, you're getting an up-close lesson in samsara every single day, especially now. So it's a good time to be talking about this. I think there's a lot of material ready made for us to take a look at. When I was listening to Claire talk in the video, and she was talking about how scary it is to realize how impactful our actions are in terms of creating the seeds for our next life. On the flip side, and she did get to this, it's also very empowering, and that's the whole point. The whole point of all of this, the class, the things you're going to be thinking about, studying, meditating, is to be empowered to make the changes that are necessary in order to liberate yourself from samsara. It's not just to freak you out. Sometimes you know your mind, and that the whole point is that all of these teachings are meant for you to take and to use to train your mind to go in the best place possible. So if you need fear at some point, then by all means, there's lots of stuff that you can use to kind of shake yourself up. Like if I got a DWI, I would go to a class where they're going to scare the hell out of me so that I won't drink and drive again, right? There's a point at times for scaring the hell out of somebody. That's even why they call it scaring the hell out of somebody. And there's a time when you need to use the tools that empower you and inspire you. And you're the only one who can know which one to use at which time, which is why Buddhism is often called, you know, a mind training more than, quote, religion, because, I mean, that's exactly what I like about it. You know, when you're supposed to know your mind and then figure out, oh, I need more of this. So we're going to be talking during this class about some of the, you know, some of the afflictions that they were talking about, some of the disturbing mind states that create the whole cycle that we get trapped into, and what are called the antidotes so that you can apply them as you see fit. There's lots of things to go over. I like to have fun because, you know, it's the end of a long work day. We're all in this weird situation. So I like these classes to be fun. And when we're in the center, I get people into small groups. We do all kinds of things. It's challenging to do it on Zoom, but I still want to have fun. So I like to kind of make sure the material is practical and useful in your daily life. We can go over all kinds of lists. We can look at the 12 links. We can do all of that. But I also want us to think about how we can use it every single day and the lessons all around us all the time that we can use and share with each other. So if there are things that you definitely know, this is where I would, if we were in the center, have a screen up and be taking down some things that you know that you definitely want to cover. So if you can, at the end we'll go over some of those, but if you can even send them in a chat to Linda, that would be helpful. Because I want to make sure, there's lots of different directions we can go in since we only have like four classes, and I want to make sure that I cover what people are really interested in. Since we've taken, you know, a lot of time with the introduction, which I think was fantastic because it really lays out what we're going to go through, I want to just hit a couple key things by means of introduction to this topic. And just defining some terms. So I'm going to read you the very kind of formal, dry definition of samsara. It's not going to be on the test. Although it may. Okay. Samsara. Oh, it's so dark in here. Hold on. Let me turn on the light. All right. What we call samsara or cyclic existence is the continuity of the contaminated, afflicted aggregates. To be reborn in samsara means to be reborn with those aggregates. As human beings, we have five aggregates. When those aggregates are contaminated by the afflictions, they are referred to as contaminated, afflicted aggregates. Well, okay, we'll get into all of that because some of it's helpful. It's basically we're on a loop over and over and over again. And all the things that we have that make us human beings, those aggregates that they're talking about, they are contaminated by these afflicted mind states. So that's why it's important to kind of understand, well, what are those mind states? What are those aggregates? How do they become afflicted? How does this wheel continue again and again and again? If you were in, well, you know, for many of us, we have this experience. We end up being in the same kind of relationships with people over and over and over again. And we might blame them all the time. Oh, my goodness, these men or women are, you know, they're just like, ugh. But if we, at some point, hopefully, we mature a little bit and go, what am I doing? What am I doing that, you know, puts me into these kinds of relationships that really aren't very helpful to me or supportive or whatever? So even on this mundane level, we try to change our behavior to get out of that kind of cycle of something that we've been stuck in. And so for yourself, between now and next class, even on a mundane level, try to come up with a couple of mind states, reactions, something that you feel that you've been kind of stuck in, so that we can talk about, that you can think about ways to be freer of that, to kind of get on a higher level with those things. Because, yes, we're talking about future lives, but also we're in this one. And there are ways in this life that we can. Everything that's around us, every single thing, is what the video was saying, is a tool for our liberation. So we can sometimes get very depressed about this samsaric prison that we're in, this prison of cyclic existence. But the meditations on the sufferings of cyclic existence, again, are meant to empower us, are meant to remind us not to get too carried away with how wonderful things can be. Like, oh, the pandemic's over. Great. But if we remember that what world we're actually in, then that's not going to be enough. And so it's meant to, you know, inspire us and keep our mind kind of going in the right direction. But every single thing we encounter is a tool for our liberation. I remember Geshe-la talking about how he brought it down to this very mundane level, which I really appreciated. So he said, you know, a jacket, because he had just gotten this brand new jacket, that's right. So he said the jacket does not provide warmth in the middle of the summer. It just provides suffering. But in the wintertime, the jacket is liberation from cold. And so in that moment of being cold, how did he put it? Yeah, in that moment of being cold, there is the door to liberation. In our moment of being angry or upset or jealous or whatever is arising in our mind, there is also the door to liberation from that. And that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about in this class, because those are the mind states, the afflicted emotions that we're talking about, that create the karmic seeds that just propel us again and again in terms of cyclic existence. We may evolve to a higher level with it, but if we really want to be free of it, we need to find ways to find the way out. So on a mundane level, you're cold. Oh, there's a jacket. Now I'm free from cold. That jacket would provide no liberation in the summer. And so similarly with the antidotes, applying the antidotes at the right time will help us find the door to liberation. I hope that's a good example. I want to also come up with a good definition for renunciation, because that's a term that we can really get kind of on the wrong path with. So the kind of formal definition, again, is renunciation is the aspiration wishing to attain liberation. But oftentimes we think of a renunciant or renunciation as somebody who goes away, who leaves everything behind, and just, I'm going to have to leave my house, leave my job, and leave my car. But renunciation, I heard this other definition that I really liked, which is that renunciation doesn't mean going away from the world. It means knowing that the world goes away. So that it means knowing things are impermanent. So if you know that the world goes away, the world that you are inhabiting at this moment, your world, your life, your everything around you is this kind of river. If you know that that river is moving on, then you treat things differently. You can still enjoy them. You can still put stuff up on your walls and, you know, paint the kitchen the color that you want it to be and enjoy it. But knowing that it is going away means that you move into it with kind of a different mind state, a different appreciation, and a different way of relating to it. So we'll get into, again, attachment and all of these things later on. But I just wanted to start with this different definition of renunciation. So again, this whole class, this whole topic is meant to be empowering. We've got lots of lists we can go over. Some of them, they went over in the video. But I just want to pause at this moment to see if there's any specific questions or comments that I can address before I move forward.
Sure. Okay. We do have a couple of questions. Well, actually, they're not questions, Steve. They're what students are hoping to cover. Do you want to hear those now?
Sure.
Okay, so one says, I am hoping Steeple will clearly define the terms truly existent and mere or merely imputed. I keep running into these terms when reading. It seems like truly existent means not existing at all. So that's one. Did you get all that, or do you want me to read it again?
I got it.
Okay. And then the other one is, I'm looking forward to learning about the antidotes.
Okay. All right, great. So the whole thing about truly and merely, I'll try to cover that at some point. That's really the whole topic of emptiness, but it comes into play. What you'll find in discovering Buddhism and in any of the classes, they all kind of weave together. So you could start over here, but it all ties into this topic over here, which all come to the Four Noble Truths. And so if I didn't realize I have COVID, I'm not going to go and get any treatment for it. And this is a pretty good example, actually, because if I just only have mild symptoms and I'm not suffering greatly, I could actually just spread it everywhere, right? So likewise, in this world, if I come in with a lot of nice things and, you know, my life is pretty, I'm privileged and I have a lot of comfortable things, I might not necessarily recognize that I'm contaminated and that everything I'm doing is just spreading the virus around myself and others. And so taking care of myself and cleaning up my infection will actually benefit me and all those people around me. So the reason that there's so much emphasis on looking at the different kinds of suffering and the Four Noble Truths, starting with the truth of suffering, is because we can sometimes, we can get lost in chasing one thing versus keeping our mind going in a right direction. So I want to, because I like to have fun, I want to play something for you that's really all about this, the same topic. So bear with me to see if I can actually show this video clip. I'm going to share my screen. Yeah, maybe this is it. So do you see it? Okay, good. All right.
Yes, we sure do. Okay. Good.
All right, this is about 1 minute. You should recognize this. And again, this is all a teaching on the nature of suffering.
Now, the good thing about being out is you don't have to be out for long. Just long enough to get the next feeling, which you're all going to get. And that feeling is, I got to be getting back. After all the work you put into getting your ass where it is right now, you're only halfway through this nightmare at this point. Wherever you are, really anywhere in life, at some point, you got to get the hell out of it. You're at work, you want to get home. You're home, I'm working all week, I gotta get out. You're out, it's late, you gotta get back. You gotta get up, you gotta get to the airport. When are we getting on the plane? Plane takes off. When's the plane gonna land? Plane lands. Why don't they open the door so we can get out? Nobody wants to be anywhere. Nobody likes anything. We're cranky, we're irritable. And we're dealing with it by constantly changing locations.
Okay. I watched that the other night and I thought, he is describing, by the way, the suffering of change. So in the video, you heard a little bit about it. There's three types of suffering. The second one is the suffering of change, which sometimes, that's the one that we sometimes forget about quite a bit. Because, like he's saying, we work really hard to get to that show, right? So we've bought the tickets, we get there, we get dressed, we get a sitter, we get in the car, we get to this place, and now we're enjoying ourselves. But if we had to stay there for 24 hours, we probably would not be enjoying ourselves. So whatever is comfortable for us, eventually it becomes the cause of our suffering. Say we've been sitting down all day at work, so we can't wait to stand up. And now we're standing up and we're walking. But after a while, if we're standing up and walking for too long, this brings us discomfort. And so then we want to sit down again. And so on and on it goes. In fact, that's one of the reasons why, as he said, we always have to keep moving, is why we are, in Tibetan Buddhism, we're called migratory beings. Some is just because of the lifetimes that we take over and over again, but also because there's never a complete contentment, which is one of the things to explore when we're looking at how we all want happiness. So that saying that we all want happiness really goes pretty deeply if we can look at, well, what is happiness? You know, it's again, it's not saying that we shouldn't go and have fun, but to make sure that we understand that it's not going to provide for the ultimate happiness that we all actually do want. So I enjoyed that. The other thing that I wanted to just share with you all on kind of a mundane level, because I think sometimes I get the question from people in this class of, people generating the wish to get out of samsara, but what about while we're here? So, you know, working on these things that I'm working on are meaningless, right? And I remember asking Geshe-la, like, how frustrating it seems to work for peace, because, you know, there's never really been peace on the whole planet. And he said to me, if peace is possible for a minute, it's possible for an hour. And if it's possible for an hour, it's possible for a day, and on and on. And that helped me a lot, because for two reasons. One is it helped me see that we don't have to just be looking at something outside of this world. That's why I think in the video, again, they're talking about all of it's right here. But also all the things that we have in our life are tools to help us get there. So let me just show you this quote I wrote down, because I was not sure how I'm going to bring that up. Oh, maybe it's now. Not that one. Well, rats. Anyway, it's a quote. Actually, maybe I have it here. I was reading this book, this woman who worked for President Obama, and this is a part of a speech that he gave. I can find it. I'm sorry. That he gave when he received the Pulitzer Prize. And I thought it fit really well with this whole topic of, well, okay, while I'm waiting for that to work, if it's not one contraption, it's another. Okay, here we go. All right, so he said, I believe that peace is unstable where citizens are denied the right to speak freely or worship as they please, choose their own leaders, or assemble without fear. We can acknowledge that oppression will always be with us and still strive for justice. We can admit that intractability, we can admit the intractability of deprivation and still strive for dignity. Clear-eyed, we can understand that there will be war and still strive for peace. It's almost, it's in that striving that we are creating our very liberation, even if we can't do away with samsara for everybody else. So there was this monk, this Chinese monk, who escaped China and was in exile in the United States. And as an older man, he was able to go back to China. And he wanted to rebuild this very small monastery that he'd been in as a boy. And he found the place and he started rebuilding it. And some of his family there were saying, you know, that's just ridiculous because they're just going to tear it down again. And he said, well, then, you know, but let my karma be of rebuilding. You know, that's their business. If they want to tear it down, let that be their karmic, you know, seeds that they're planting. But at least mine will be that I've rebuilt this. And so in that way, it helps me keep my mind on what I'm doing here and what I can do, and not just renouncing the kind of work that I do in this world and saying that's not important. Actually, that is the stuff of my liberation, depending on what kind of mindset I bring to it. You know, that Lama Zogu Rinpoche talks all the time about how to go grocery shopping with bodhicitta, how to cut somebody's hair with bodhicitta. There's so many things that we can do with that kind of mind of being of benefit to ourselves and others. It's just everywhere. So we don't need to move away from that. We actually just need to change the way that we enter into it. Okay, so let me give you the five aggregates, because this is something that is important as we're talking about the basis for renunciation and the basis for liberation. So, and if you want them written later, you know, I can get you a lot of this material, and it should be in all the DB material for this module. Linda, we can talk about that before the class ends, about how people can get some of the readings and everything. So the five aggregates are form. So I always remember that the two first ones start with F. Form, just the whole shape of what we're talking about here. Your own form, form of your world. Feeling. And by feeling, it's just simply sensation. You know, I like this, I don't like this, this feels good. You know, that's just simply feeling, the sensation of feeling. The third one is perception. And by that, it's really our ability to kind of discriminate among things. You know, this is a piece of paper, this is a pencil, and so that we can label things. Without that ability to perceive the differences between things, we wouldn't be able to label them. This gets a little bit to the inherently existing and merely labeled things. So this is why the five aggregates are important. Mental formations. And that means really like the mental volition, which impels us to do things. It can be like, you know, having jealousy. So the ideas that you start forming in your mind through your perception and your feeling, that then impels you to do something that creates the karmic seeds. Hope that makes sense. And the last one is consciousness. I missed one. Is consciousness, which is the sense gates through which we perceive the world. And it is basically the story, then our story, which is also a constantly shifting thing. Form, feeling, perception, mental. Oh, that's five. Okay. Consciousness is the, in a, kind of a more modern way to say that would be our story. But I think we kind of get what we notice when we think about consciousness. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's all kinds of very complicated ways of labeling all the different kinds of consciousness, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, the sense organs. It gets incredibly complicated, but that's enough to get you started. So those five aggregates we all have, and it's based on those five aggregates that you can label yourself you, and I can label myself me. And those aggregates kind of come together. And now we have Linda. And then those five aggregates dissolve. Right? So that's the everything that comes together goes apart. The aggregates of this class are all of you and me. And we've all come together through Zoom. And when we end the class, we'll all go away and you can no longer say there's a class being held. Right now we can say there's a class being held. But this is so, it's like we're just cutting the tip of the iceberg of all these huge, huge complicated topics, but at least there's something there. So in these five aggregates of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, can you find any self there? That becomes the question in Buddhism. Can you find in any of those, like you'd be looking through a box of these five aggregates, where is the self? Just like in this class, where is the class? Okay, it's the collection of all these things. You know, the Zoom meeting, Linda's doing all the work that she has done, me arriving with this material, you all tuning in. If any one of these didn't exist, it'd be hard to say there was a class going on. If nobody attended, it was just me and Linda, not so sure this would be labeled a class. So all of them kind of need to come together. If we didn't have Zoom and we're all just sitting in our houses, parts of this would exist, but they wouldn't all exist and we couldn't label it a class. So it's existing, but where is it? You know, where exactly is it? It's very hard to grab. That's why people say something is merely labeled, to help us kind of shake up that feeling that it's really solid. You know, we all understand it or else we wouldn't, you know, it would be very bizarre if we didn't understand that this is class. But it's so kind of elusive. And thinking about that and meditating on it helps us kind of shake up that view that we have that things are solid, things are permanent, things are going to function in this kind of a way. If we can shake that up a little bit, then this shakes up the way that we act. It shakes up the way that we create these karmic seeds that we're talking about. That's what a lot of this is helping us do, is kind of shake up our view so that we don't get too pulled in one direction or another by our mental formations, that we can see that, oh yeah, this is a river, right? So, you know, that whole example that's used quite a bit of you never put your foot in the same river twice, right? Because what is the river? Is it the water? Is it the tunnel, that the little channel that the water is moving through? But if that's true, you know, well, what about the very source of the river? That's a different part. You know, it just gets, we all can see it. We all can label it river. We can all find the Mississippi. We can all get on a boat and say, I'm on the Mississippi River. So it depends on all those parts. So likewise, I often think of myself as like a river. And right now in this lifetime, I'm this bend in the river. I'm not able to see what came before, and I'm not able to see what's going forward, but I'm responsible for the river right now. And so what I can do is try to clean up as much crap that's in the river from upstream and put in as much good things as I possibly can into the water now. That's my job. But I think we get often, at least speaking for myself, because I don't have that big picture view. It's like when I lived in New York City, and I'm walking between these huge, tall buildings. Sometimes if you look at the end of the block, there's a boat going by. I grew up in New Orleans, and that's really true in New Orleans. You can just see at the end of the block, there's this the top of this big ship moving down. So if I think about it, then I realize, oh, something came before that block. If I just trust my eyes, it's just there's water right there. That's it. That's all there is this water, block full of water. But if I really think and analyze it, I can see that things are moving. So something must have come before and something's going further. So this river is actually a large body. Where can you find the beginning of that river? Where will it end? So on and so forth. All meant to be empowering us. And then all the meditations on the affliction. So let me go through what the afflictions are just so you have this list. But all the meditations that we do on the afflictions are meant to help us let go of unskillful and unhelpful thoughts. So the whole reason we meditate is so that we can start to recognize as thoughts arise, so that then we can do something with them. Because when they're really, when they're a little tsunami or even a wave of emotion, it's really hard to do anything at that point. But for those of you who are taking yoga, I remember when I was younger and I was taking some, it helped me realize when tension was entering my body so that I could actually do something and kind of relax my shoulder or take a deeper breath or stretch. But if I didn't recognize when it was coming in, it was going to take over. Well, the same thing with our mind. So recognizing as something is arising, what can we do? What antidotes can we apply? What bigger picture can we bring so that we can let go of the unhelpful thoughts? It's not that we let go of the things that we need or are important to us. It's that we let go of a direction that we might be carried along with on that tide. Okay. So the six delusions in your own life, and we'll go over these in more detail in future classes. Anger, attachment, and when we say attachment, it's such like, I think the wrong word, but it's more like grasping and clinging, because there's positive attachment that we all need in order to form bonds with our parents, our children, and so on and so forth. But it's the clinging to things and the inability to see the impermanence of things that causes the problem. And we'll talk a lot more about that. Ignorance, pride, doubt, and wrong view. Wrong view mainly meaning that things exist inherently. So that gets back to that question, which is that they exist very solidly from their own side. You'll hear all of these terms. That they exist when we're trying to break apart that wrong view. One of the first things to meditate on is that everything arises based on causes and conditions. That things arise dependently on other things. So nothing exists out by its own little self, right? Everything exists based on causes and conditions. That's great news. That's great news. So one time I asked Geshe-la, I guess it was probably when after Hurricane Katrina, my mother came to live with me and it was just really difficult and she had dementia. And, at some point she was in a nursing facility and I'd go there every day and it was just a lot of the really awful parts of, impermanence that I was drowning in. And I remember asking Geshe-la, so I'm getting quite an overload on the lessons of impermanence. I said, what's the antidote for it? Like, I'm getting depressed. What's the antidote to all of this impermanence I'm witnessing? And he said, oh, that's easy. You have to meditate on what's coming. Because just because things disintegrate doesn't mean that something doesn't arise. Now, it's hard in a nursing home because I don't know why it's going to arise. But I can imagine, and that was so helpful, that just because I'm just looking at things disintegrating and I'm forgetting that, oh, something arises. And when one of his monks who was visiting died not that much longer, and a lot of us had gotten to know him, and so we were all kind of reeling from this news, and he said, okay, just be careful not to go too far down that. He goes, because our sadness is somebody else's joy, meaning that his monk, he was like, he's probably reborn now. And, you know, that's somebody else's joy. So we can also meditate on that. So I kind of went rambling off there. Let me take a break and take some questions, and then we're going to kind of wrap up.
We do have a few questions, Steve. Okay. A couple of them pertain to renunciation. So the first one is, does renunciation also refer to suffering, that it will end?
Yes, absolutely. That is what we're renouncing. We are renouncing suffering. It just, how do we get there? How do we get to it? But that is definitely what we're renouncing. We're renouncing the suffering of samsaric existence. And so in our, you know, our Western language, we think of it so much, though, as like a renunciate goes off to the cave and they wear just, you know, this tiny little piece of cloth. And so that's why I wanted to kind of throw in that what we're actually doing is we're understanding that the world goes away, that we don't have to leave the world. The world is actually what is our best chance to liberate ourselves. We don't separate ourselves from the very thing. You know, it's other beings that provide every opportunity for us to liberate, enhance, to create good merit, all of that stuff. So I hope that answered that.
Okay. And the other question about renunciation is, can you speak to how renunciation applies to relationships? I find the concept is clear for material things, but I struggle with how to view relationships as impermanent. How can you love and not suffer loss?
Yeah, I don't know. I'll let you know if I find out. But I do know that Geshe has talked a lot about how love and attachment, because of the world we live in, you know, it's so hard to just have pure love without attachment. It's like separating milk and water. If you mix milk and water, how are you going to strain out the milk and the water? But we're not renouncing. I mean, we're so interdependent. We're not renouncing our interdependence. You know, we're not renouncing our interdependence. We are trying to renounce our clinging. So, and it doesn't mean that we're not going to be sad. You know, I think I misunderstood Buddhism for a long time. But it's not that we're going to be sad. But I think, at least for me, what I try to do is have a lot of other tools. So, you know, like in terms of when I was taking care of my mother and how hard that was, and then when she died, the looking at what was causing me pain at times, you know. So even now, when I think about some of the horrors that we went through, I have to stop and go, oh, wait a minute, you know, she's not there anymore in that suffering. I am. I'm the one going back to that awful memory. I am there, but she's actually not there. And other times when I've lost people, you know, there's this book written by this woman whose husband died suddenly. It's called The Year of Magical Thinking. Maybe some of you know. Oh, I can't remember her name now. She's a famous writer. It's a wonderful book. And it was just this sudden death. And so she's just thrown into this tizzy. And she's writing about it that whole year. And at one point, this is my favorite part in the book, she said, every once in a while I stop and think, oh, what can I be doing for him? Or where is he? Or how is he? That to me is the key. It's like, so yes, of course I have this loss and it hurts and it is very painful. Can I shift gears a little bit and think, what can I do for that being? If I believe that consciousness continues, you know, what can I do? And that's again something I feel is very helpful in Buddhism. And when Geshe was living with me, I had, you know, I was much younger, and I had this dog, and we loved this dog, and she died. And so I remember I was sad, and Geshe said, okay, make a very strong wish that she's in your very first circle of disciples when you reach Buddhahood. I'd never heard anything like that before, and but it was such a wonderful thing to do, to like switch and go, oh, right, we'll keep circling around each other over and over and over again. Why not make a wish that that's where I see her next? So, you know, everything rides on our wish, our motivation, our intention. We emphasize that over and over again in Buddhism. But think about where that also is true for you in your own life. That's a good thing to think about this week. Okay, that's your homework. Where does motivation help you in your own life? Where do you maybe forget it? But where could it help you on just a very mundane level? So, for example, I work as a mediator, and I train mediators in the court system, social work mediators. And I'm training them how to frame things that they're saying and how to listen. And one of the things I tell them, which they really have come to value, is that even if they get some of these techniques wrong in the skills that we're using in mediation, if their intention is to hear somebody, that will come through, and the person will feel that and be heard. If their intention is not to listen, but just to use these techniques we're teaching them, then that will also come through. So before the mediation session, if they really sit there and develop this strong intention to help the parties who are coming into their office, that's what's going to carry them through 2 hours of a very difficult conversation. And if they skip that part, you know, likewise. So think about that moving forward. What was the original question? I just went off on it.
The original question was like, can you speak to renunciation and how it applies to relationships? Yes. And the book that you mentioned, The Year of Magical Thinking, a student says it's Joan Didion.
Thank you.
The author's name.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of other questions if you're ready for those.
Yeah.
Okay. So speaking of yoga, I have been having deeper aversions when I get into the deep practice, almost nauseating. What can we do at that place?
Are you talking, and you can unmute yourself, are you talking about yoga? Like
the practice of yoga. Naga, can you unmute yourself? Let me see. Ah, there she is.
Hi. It's not like a super, it's not nauseating because of I'm doing hard work. It's very gentle, but as she takes us into deeper breath and physical parts of just lying down, nothing much. But still takes me to the emotional part.
Wow.
And I just feel so overwhelmed. I've been having that for the last 2 days, I think.
There's a lot going on in the world. So I don't think you're alone in being on the edge of a lot of emotions. And, it would take a lot more for me to really help you figure that out. But I would say, talk to your yoga teacher, first of all, and then also try to see if you can even label what those feelings are. So in meditation, what we do a lot is we're trying to create a kind of a little space between our thoughts so that if we're just like in our breathing, if we're focusing on our breathing, we'll see there's a pause between our inhale and our exhale. And if we can, and we'll do this next week. And then, we can sometimes start to see that our thoughts kind of come up like a wave and then they go down and then there's a pause. And if we can, what we're trying to do is create as much space between those thoughts. They're not going to entirely disappear, but if we can kind of extend that pause between our thoughts, there's relief. And so likewise, when we're really overwhelmed with things in our own life or what's going on in the world, labeling it sometimes helps. Like, oh, here comes sadness. And then trying to like really watch it, shine a spotlight on it rather than trying to make it go away. Here's sadness arising. This is what it feels like. Where is it in my body? Instead of, being pulled with it. And just slowing things way down. That's just, give it a try and see what happens. For everybody, try that kind of meditation this week, and we will definitely start next week doing some.
Okay. And then Naga also had a second question. Can we also wish not to see some people again in our rebirth?
You can wish. You can wish everything, but you know, the if you can find the best wishes, you know, how can we, if we are stuck in a difficult dance with another person, what is it, you know, even if we, let me just slow down. Sometimes we need to get away from the object or the person in order not to continue to create more negativity. So there's nothing wrong with stepping away from something, just as we do with sugar, alcohol, tobacco, whatever it is that we need to avoid so that it doesn't create more negativity. Same thing we can do with a person that we haven't figured it out yet with. We can take a break and step back and say, you know, I can't do this. If we, the highest place to be would be to do that with still wishing them well. You know, it's not working well with me and this person, but I wish them well, and I, you know, you need to protect your mind. So that's as much as I can say about that. I mean, just is trying to keep it, you know, yeah, trying to just step back without any of the negativity. And so that, you know, you can wish, there's certainly people that I wish that in the future I'm not stuck in anything with them anymore. You know, and you can also wish that, I've heard this, it's a beautiful prayer, you know, that even, you know, even the negative things that I've done in my life, may those things be the cause for somebody else's enlightenment or benefit or whatever. So even the ways that I have, that I regret the way that I've acted in this situation or that situation, maybe that could, I wish that that actually be of benefit to that person, and that they be free. If you start to see that we're all in prison together, then, you know, what we're wishing for is that we're all out of prison. We're all out of this prison. You don't want to just wish that the cell looks better. Oh, gee, I wish I had, you know, a bigger cell. I mean, you can wish that, sure. But as long as you realize that that's what, that it's a bigger picture than just that, that you're not getting fooled that, oh, now it's comfortable because I have a better bed. Or, you know, the lights out or whatever. I'm wishing that I can find the way out of this prison, because if, when I just keep coming back to this prison, it's just a different, you know, it doesn't really get any better. All right. So was any last question?
We have one more from a student who's watching on the live YouTube streaming. And her question is the mental formation category, this is one of the five aggregates, the same as compositional factors?
I will get back to you on that. I want to make sure I have the exact right answers, because, yeah, you're right that there's lots of different terms for it. I believe so. But let me make 100% sure. And hopefully this person will be watching next week.
And I think... Looks like we covered all the questions that have been posed so far.
Okay, so thank you everyone for your patience and your attendance in Zoom. So take this moment to think about all the seeds that you created to attend this today. I mean, there was that took a lot for all of us to figure this out, to attend. I mean, there's a lot of Zoom fatigue. And so you just created an enormous amount of merit by attending, participating, thinking about these topics. As Geshe-la would always say, you know, how many people are doing this in North Carolina at this moment? You know, it's special. It's powerful. And so you now, in your mind stream, if you're that river, you've just thrown in a lot of wonderful seeds. And by dedicating it, you now direct where you want it to blossom, where you want those seeds to grow. So take a minute for yourself and think about how you would like this merit, these positive seeds, to develop. and I would encourage you to think about having them eliminate any obstacles between you and your liberation. That these very seeds that you've created will join any other seeds you've created and become the cause for your complete enlightenment, which will benefit everyone. Just the same way as when you're having a good day and you're smiling and kind, you're benefiting everyone around you. When you reach complete enlightenment and are no longer prisoner of these afflictions, how powerful that will be. So thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next week. Feel free to let me know if there's certain things that you, certain questions you have or things that come up. But otherwise, we'll talk about that homework next week of looking at your life in relation to the things we've been discussing, in particular your motivation, you know, how your motivation each day affects your work, your life, your relationships in a positive or not so positive way. Okay. Thank you, Steve. All right. Take good care, everybody.
And if anyone has questions and can't find anything, please email me. I did put that in the chat box, but the email address is program.db@kadampa-center.org. All right. Thanks, everyone. Have a good night, and we'll see you next week, next Monday. Thanks, Steve.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you.